Hello, and welcome to the Recommendation Roundtable on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be recommending entertainment options that you might find interesting. The way these episodes work is listeners send in clips with recommendations on how you might want to spend your spare time. Various forms of entertainment will be spotlighted, such as video games, books, movies, television shows, and anything else people can think of that we might find enjoyable. So with that, let's get going and see what we've got this time around.
Dr. Mo here with another pick for the Recommendation Roundtable. It's Robin 2, Joker is Wild. In my previous Recommendation Roundtable recording, I recommended the first Robin miniseries that was written by Chuck Dixon, which really helped shed a spotlight on Tim Drake. Now, the second miniseries continues Tim Drake's journey to becoming more or less a confident and competent Robin. Now, as you probably guessed by the title, the Joker is a quintessential part of this four-issue miniseries. Now, the setup for this miniseries is that Batman has departed Gotham City for whatever reason. The Joker has escaped Arkham. Chaos ensues. Tim Drake and Alfred are kind of left to deal with the situation. Now, this is a really interesting plot there because if you remember correctly, the Joker in his last big story arc prior to this had killed Jason Todd, the second Robin, which of course triggered Bruce's downward spiral, ultimately leading to Tim Drake seeking out Dick and eventually earning his place as the new Robin. So, you know, obviously, this is a fundamental question that the comics fans were wondering at that time is how would Tim Drake handle the Joker? And I have to say that, and I'm not going to spoil the solution because this is a very solid miniseries. Again, if you enjoyed the first Robin mini, you will definitely enjoy Joker's Wild. It has the exact same creative team of Chuck Dixon, Tom Blau, Bob Smith with the inks, Adrian Roy with the colors. And there's a consistency here and that you know the kind of storytelling that you're going to get. I think that this miniseries does a wonderful job of fleshing out and developing Tim Drake's relationship with Alfred. He starts to call Alfred Alfie. These are things that kind of continue throughout, you know, the ongoing Robin series. They introduce or more or less give names to some of Tim Drake's friends, such as Ives, who become a bigger part of Tim Drake's supporting cast in the ongoing Robin series. Again, Chuck Dixon is really laying the groundwork for the types of stories he would be telling with Tim Drake long term. The artwork by Tom Blau, it really much kind of fits the mold of that early 90s Batman art style. Again, heavy influences by Jim Aparo at that time. Because Tom Blau has some really good acting, some really nice fight scenes, very clear storytelling. If anything, I would say it's very solid on those sort of fundamentals. It's not necessarily what you would call bombastic or eye-catching, but Tom Blau is a solid draftsman, and he knows how to make these characters work. And Lau's art really complements Chuck Dixon's storytelling. Now, if you are interested in reading Robin 2, Joker's Wild, it can be found on the DC Universe app. Just search for Robin 2, Joker's Wild. You can also find it on Comixology. You can get the single issues, or you can get a digital trade. The digital trade is called Robin Volume 2 Triumph. And this digital trade contains not only the second Robin miniseries, Joker's Wild, but also the third Robin miniseries. And it also contains some issues of Batman as well. Now, before I wrap this up, I do want to mention kind of one of the most unique 90s-esque aspects of this series. Has nothing to do with the interiors, but it's just one of those fun facts. Like, when this miniseries came out, it was widely known for its multiple covers, and it had the sort of hologram. It was a standard cover showing, depicting various characters and poses. One of the covers, for instance, for the first issue, had the Joker on, and he was holding what should have been a playing card, and instead of a drawn playing card, it was a little holographic card. And clearly DC sort of saw what was going on at Marvel at the time with the multiple covers for X-Men, the multiple covers for X-Force, and so forth, and kind of capitalized on that. Because again, the first Robin minis was really hot, and it went into multiple printings. So why not have multiple covers for it? You know, if you had that collector mentality, it was like, oh my gosh, I've got to get all these covers, because some was done by Lyle, some was done by Kevin Maguire, Dan Jurgens did the covers. So, you know, if you were into covers, it certainly contributed to the cover craze. But again, these covers were gimmicky, but it had nothing to do with how solid the storytelling mechanics. Robin 2, Joker's Wild, can be found again on the DCU app, Comixology. I recommend this wholeheartedly for fans of the Tim Drake character. Certainly if fans of Batman comics doing this early 90s era, which was really fascinating. You're coming out of that dark, gritty kind of period, the post-Jason Todd death period, and you were getting something that felt like a traditional Batman and Robin, but with more modern sensibilities.
Hi, I'm Billy Hogan, host of the Superman Fan Podcast, and I go by Superman Fan on the forums. I would like to share three superhero movies that I think are very underrated and deserve a second look. The first one is Mystery Men, released in 1999. They are based on a group of comic book characters from the Flaming Carrot comic book series. Now, if you're not familiar with Flaming Carrot, he was a man who went insane after reading 5,000 comic books in order to win a bet. He wore a carrot mask with a flame at the top, and he wore a pair of fins in case he needed to swim. Like the Flaming Carrot, the Mystery Men film was a superhero spoof. It starred Greg Kinnear as Captain Amazing, hero of Champion City. Hank Azaria was known as the Blue Raja, who was able to throw cutlery with extreme accuracy. Janine Garofalo was the bowler, who wielded a clear crystal bowling ball with the skull of her late father inside. He was Carmine the Bowler, who died fighting the gang the Disco Boys. William H. Macy was the shoveler, because he wielded a shovel in order to fight crime. Kel Mitchell was the Invisible Boy, who can only turn invisible when no one is looking. Paul Rubens of Pee Wee Herman fame was the Spleen, who knocked out the bad guys by his super flatulence. Ben Stiller was Mr. Furious, whose power was his rage, but he had trouble getting mad enough. The main villain was Casanova Frankenstein, played by Jeffrey Rush, and that's my favorite supervillain name. Eddie Izzard was Tony P, leader of the Disco Boys gang, and the Mystery Men upped their game by being taught by the Sphinx, who was played by Wes Studi. The Sphinx was a mysterious superhero who was able to use his mind to cut guns in half. The singer Tom Waits played Doc Heller, who made non-lethal weapons for the Mystery Men. When Captain Amazing was kidnapped by Casanova Frankenstein, the original Mystery Men tried to rescue him, but were very unsuccessful. After getting beaten badly, they recruited more members and were trained by the Sphinx. It certainly isn't a serious superhero movie like those done by Marvel or DC. It's just a lot of fun. It's almost cartoony and a very lighthearted superhero movie, which I think, especially in these days, is a nice break from the grim, depressing superhero films of recent years, not to mention the grim situation that we're living through right now. You should still be able to find copies of the DVD online, or maybe it's on a streaming service. Despite the fact that it was a financial flop and its box office did not earn back the cost of the movie, I would still recommend it as a fun movie just to sit down, eat some popcorn, and watch a fun film that you don't have to really think about. Just watch and enjoy yourself. And I would rate this one a B. The second underrated movie I would recommend is The Phantom, released in 1996. It's based on the King Features comic strip character who premiered in comic strip pages on February of 1936, predating Superman. Billy Zane starred as Kit Walker, the 21st Phantom, also known as the Ghost Who Walks. Christy Swanson starred as Kit Walker's girlfriend, Diana Palmer. Treat Williams was the business tycoon and villain Xander Drax, who was searching for three mystical skulls who were the key to the ultimate power. The Phantom discovers that Drax is linked to the ancient Singh Brotherhood pirate organization, villains who were enemies all the way back to the very first Phantom. The film takes place in the 1930s, where Phantom's comic strip began. It's a great adventure movie who captures the era perfectly, including all the tropes of the Phantom, like the Skull Cave, the Bandar tribe, who are the only ones who know that the Phantom is mortal and is succeeded by the sons upon the Phantom's death. The movie does a very clever job of incorporating the Phantom Chronicles, where all the past Phantoms keep a journal of their adventures so that their descendants can learn from them. My only criticism is that Treat Williams chews the scenery a bit too much as the movie's villain. Otherwise, it's a great adaptation of one of my favorite adventure comic strips ever, and the other is Prince Valiant. I would give this one a B+. My third and final underrated movie I would recommend is The Rocketeer, which was released in 1991 by Disney. Billy Campbell starred as Cliff Secord, who was the Rocketeer. Jennifer Connelly was Ginny Blake, who was inspired by the pinup model Betty Blake, and who Rocketeer comic book artist Dave Stevens drew as a cartoon version of Betty Blake. She was Cliff's girlfriend. Alan Arkin was P.V. Peabody, Cliff's airplane mechanic. Timothy Dalton was the British actor Neville Sinclair, who was modeled after Douglas Fairbanks or Errol Flynn. Terry O'Quinn from the series Lost was Howard Hughes, and Paul Sorvino was the mob leader Eddie Valentine. The Rocketeer began as a comic book series written and drawn by Dave Stevens in 1982, who sadly died of leukemia in 2008. The film adapts the story, but doesn't slavishly follow the comic book plot. It's an excellent adaptation that captures the spirit of the comic book series and the times of the 1930s. Like in the comic book, in the movie, the gangsters, who were part of Valentine's gang, stole Howard Hughes' rocket pack, although the creator of the rocket pack in the comic book is a different character who was steeped in the pulp magazines. The gangsters crash in the air circus that Cliff and Peavy work at, destroying the GB that was the Cord's race plane. Cliff and Peavy find the rocket pack, and Cliff wants to use it to rebuild his career, but he becomes embroiled in a race to recover the jetpack between the gangsters, Nazi spies, the FBI, and Howard Hughes. It was a great action-adventure movie and one of the most underrated films I've ever seen, and I've got to give this one a solid A. I'm sure Disney's streaming service would have it, although I don't know for sure, but I don't see why not. And I'm sure you could also find it on maybe other streaming services. And you should probably be able to find a DVD of it online. Hi, I'm Billy Hogan, host of the Superman Fan Podcast, and I go by Superman Fan on the forums, and I would like to do a series of recommendations about my favorite superheroes. And since I do a podcast on Superman, of course, the Man of Steel is going to be on the top of my list. When I was a kid in the middle 1960s and I first began to learn how to read, I guess what drew me to Superman was he was all powerful. Now, looking back at those stories, it's obvious he was a little too overpowered, but that was part of the charm back then. But today, looking at him as an almost 60-year-old man, Superman is the ultimate immigrant. He has superpowers because of his physiology, being born on Krypton, but he became the Man of Steel because of the values he learned growing up outside a small town in Kansas. He has the power to rule the world, but the wisdom not to, which takes an incredible amount of humility, you could almost say super humility, which is the foundation of the character, I think, and it's some of the values that we need today. He faces challenges too big for normal people to protect the planet that he has adopted as his home. He doesn't have the greatest rogues gallery when you compare him to Batman, but he does have one of the strongest supporting casts in comic books. And I enjoy reading about his civilian life as Clark Kent as I do all of his superhero adventures, which is part of my concern with Brian Michael Bendis's decision to have Clark Kent reveal his secret identity to the world, but I've enjoyed a lot of what he's done with the character, so I'm going to stick with it. It's also been an interesting part of the character that he doesn't want to be a superhero 24/7, that he would also want to have a life away from the cape. There have been a lot of fantastic, timeless stories over the decades that stand the test of time, even past decades when he was written more for a child's level. He may not be the most popular DC superhero or the most popular comic book character in general, but I think he's the character that we need today to inspire us now more than ever. Later, I'm going to do some recommendations on some older Superman stories that I would recommend you read, most of whom have been reprinted, but for now I'm going to stick with looking at my favorite comic book characters in general. So on to number two. Number two on my list of favorite superheroes are the League of Superheroes, which began in 1958, and so I'm almost as old as the Legion. They combined science fiction and comic books even more so than Superman. The Legionnaires are a large cast, but unlike the X-Men, you don't need to wade through many titles to follow the characters. It's almost like a 30th or 31st century co-ed fraternity, complete with hazing, especially with the early stories. But what's more appealing than even their adventures is the relationships between the Legionnaires, the camaraderie, and even the loves that develop between the Legion. The stories run the gamut from the emotions of love to tragedy because there are characters that die over the years. Part of what has made the Legionnaires endure over the decades is the devoted fan base that has developed, to the point that some Legion fans even started their own fanzines or amateur press associations where there would be a group to get together, one person would be the central mailer, and everyone would write an article or draw a story or something that has to do with the Legion, send it to the central mailer, he or she would put it all together, have copies made and then sent to all the other members of their club or APA. There have even been professional writers that have written the Legion who came out of Legion fandom. I think it's a great way to introduce young readers into comic books. thanks to all of the collected editions of past Legion stories. Over the decades, as the comic book readership matured, so did the Legion, and so did the storytelling style of the characters. If you like strong character-driven stories and aren't all just about who the villain is we're going to punch next, then I would recommend the Legion. For those who like science fiction as much as comic book fans. In recent months, DC Comics has once again started a new monthly Legion title, which I'm glad of because I've been waiting for that since Rebirth several years ago. So my hope is that there are enough Legion fans out there that can make this new series last for a long time. Billy Hogan again. My third comic book superhero universe I would recommend is Astro City, which is one of the best alternative superhero universes I've ever found in comic books. Sadly, I'm late coming to Astro City, although I've been familiar with it for a long time. I only started following it when it began a short publication history with DC Comics before it ended to go to straight to trade stories, which haven't seen any yet, but I'm looking forward to when they do start up again. What set it apart was it didn't just show superheroes battling supervillains, but it looked at life behind the mask. The cable channel VH1 used to have a series called Behind the Music, where it looked at the life and careers of different rock and roll groups and singers. And that's kind of what Astro City is for superheroes. It's life behind the mask. It also looks at what it's like for normal people to live in a world where superheroes and supervillains exist. A lot of the stories show what life is like for superheroes and villains between battles and how their super careers affect their lives. These stories are very personal, character-driven stories, which is one of my favorite aspects of comic books. So it's not always about what superhero and villain is going to get hit next, like your average comic book superhero story. There are superhero battles against villains, but unlike the average superhero story, Astro City shows the aftermath and the consequences of those fights for everyone around them, including the characters involved. Some characters in Astro City are archetypes or analogs for some of the most famous superheroes. Almost all of these stories are very personal, told through the eyes of the main character, who could be a superhero, supervillain, or an innocent bystander trying to get through life every day, trying to live around superheroes and supervillains battling. It explores superheroes in a way that DC and Marvel don't or can't, because those two publishers, they have to keep their characters viable so that they can be adapted to movies, TV, video games, or merchandising. So if you like more than just a run-of-the-mill superhero story, I would recommend Astro City. There are a lot of collected editions, and I plan on eventually getting all of those collected editions so I can enjoy the world of Astro City. The fourth superhero universe I would recommend is the Black Hammer universe, which is currently being published by Dark Horse Comics. Most of the main characters are pretty obvious analogs of DC heroes. They save the Earth from a cosmic threat, but they pay a lot of great personal consequences for it. The heroes deal with their new normal with mixed results. Their story takes some interesting twists and turns over the series. The Black Hammer universe has had a number of miniseries that explore some of the main characters, mostly the supporting cast of both heroes and villains. Many of them are also analogs for DC heroes and characters, but not to the point of being just copycats or shallow copies, but they are their own unique characters and don't just copy the same tropes of the DC characters they're inspired by. The leader of the Black Hammer heroes is Black Hammer himself, whose power is derived by a large black hammer. Abraham Slam, I would consider him more like the Golden Age character Wildcat. He has no powers, just some hard fists, Golden Gale, I would say, is more like Mary Marvel from the original Billy Batson Captain Marvel. Colonel Weird is pretty much Adam Strange. Madame Dragonfly is a witch. She's a magical-based character like Constantine, Doctor Strange, or Zatanna or Zatara, the magician characters from DC Comics. Barb Alien is born on Mars, and he's kind of a copy of John Johns, a Martian Manhunter, but he has some original twist to the character. Barb Alien feels exiled not only on Earth, but in his home planet of Mars. You can also explore the Black Hammer universe in a number of miniseries, Sherlock Frankenstein and the Legion of Evil, where Sherlock Frankenstein is kind of the genius supervillain of the Black Hammer universe. You could compare him to Lex Luthor. In that miniseries, Lucy Weber, the daughter of the original Black Hammer, begins searching about her father, Joseph Weber, and her search leads her to some of her dad's greatest villains. She uncovers some of their dark origins and how they are tied to the mystery about what happened to Spiral City's greatest heroes. It's very interesting, and it has a surprise twist towards the end of one of the greatest enemies of the Black Hammer universe. And this was one of the most interesting supervillain stories I've ever read. There was a single-issue story titled Cthulhuise, Daughter of Cthulhu, who was a plumber named Lou, who became influenced by the dark horror character Cthulhu. This is the darkest story I've read from the Black Hammer universe because it's steeped in the horror genre as Cthulhuise struggles about which part of her heritage she will identify with, her human heritage or her more horrific monster heritage. Next, there was a miniseries titled Dr. Star and the Kingdom of Lost Tomorrows, although the name has since been changed, apparently, to Dr. Andromeda. He's kind of a Starman-Green Lantern combination. He is a retired hero who attempts to reconcile with his adult son. It's maybe the most personal and emotional story from the Black Hammer universe because it explores what consequences the family of a spacefaring superhero may face. Then we have the Quantum Age, who are obviously modeled after the Legion of Superheroes. They were inspired by the 20th century hero Black Hammer, who regroup after a battle in the past where one of the Quantum Age members makes a hard decision in a battle against an interstellar invasion, which has severe consequences. And one of the goals of the revived Quantum Age group is to attempt to solve the mystery about what happened to the great heroes of the 20th or 21st century. The miniseries Black Hammer 45 is about the final mission of the Black Hammer Squadron in World War II when they attempt to rescue a scientist and his family who are pursued not only by the Nazis but by the Russians themselves. They combine the historic Tuskegee Airmen, which was a black fighter squadron of all African Americans, with the comic book group The Blackhawks. So Jeff Lemire and his various artists have really crafted a rich, interesting comic book universe for any superhero fan to become part of. The fifth superhero universe I want to mention is Invincible. I began following the series with the 50 Cent issue Zero, which came out 2 years after the series began in 2003. This one is the ultimate exploration of the superhero universe using a twist on the Superman story. Instead of the baby Kal-El coming in a rocket, the father Jor-El comes to Earth and marries an Earth woman, and they have a son who begins to develop superpowers when he reaches puberty. There is a big twist early in the series that affects the stories going forward. And where I think Invincible exceeds DC and Marvel is that unlike the big two, where heroes and villains battle and nothing really changes, each battle in Invincible affects the characters going forward, and the consequences have repercussions far into the future. The superhero and supervillain battles are just as bloody and messy as fights are in real life, leading to catastrophic injuries for both heroes and villains, so it's not always an all-ages title. I would categorize Invincible as a superhero comic book series that you could give to people who otherwise would have no interest in comic book superheroes, because Invincible goes beyond the run-of-the-mill superhero fights. They are very character-driven stories, and each adventure affects not only the main characters, but their relatives and their relationships as well. The main character of the series is Mark Grayson, son of Omni-Man, who came to Earth from the planet Viltrum. The series chronicles Mark growing up, not only becoming a man, but how he deals with his superhero destiny. His adventures occur not just on Earth, but involve his heritage as a Viltrumite, and Robert Kirkman and Corey Walker and later artist Ryan Ottley create one of the best superhero universes. The heroes and villains are very imaginative and original, and recently I was able to get 2 volumes that filled the gap in my collection from when the series began and when I began following it in monthly issues. So now I can read the whole series from beginning to end. One thing I enjoy about writer Robert Kirkman is that he knows how to develop characters over a long overarching story. And while I'm not a big zombie fan, I did enjoy the first volume or two of Walking Dead, and that's why I say Invincible is a good comic book series to give to those who maybe don't like superheroes in general, because even though I'm not a big zombie fan, I did enjoy reading these characters as they try to survive an apocalypse. It just happens to be a zombie apocalypse as opposed to a nuclear holocaust. So that's why Invincible is one of my all-time favorite superhero universes. My next superhero universe I enjoy is Martial Law, which is a mature readers-only superhero parody, first published in 1987 by Epic Comics, which was a Marvel imprint that allowed comic book creators to own their characters. It since went on to be published by a variety of publishers up to 2000 to 2002. Martial Law's motto is, "I'm a hero hunter. I hunt heroes. Haven't found any yet." Martial Law is really Joe Gilmore, a former super soldier from the U.S. military. He was a veteran of a future war in South America, where soldiers were genetically altered in order to be more effective on the battlefield. Now he has been deputized to be a superhero hunter in a hidden police precinct bunker in the city of San Futuro, built on the ruins of San Francisco, which was destroyed in a massive earthquake. In the first miniseries, we established that the superpowered veterans came home to become out-of-control superheroes. Martial Law works to keep them under control, wearing what you could describe a leather or fetish uniform, complete with barbed wire wrapped around his bare right arm. His main target in this first 6-issue miniseries is the Public Spirit, who is an analog of Superman, while he's investigating also a serial killer of women who dress as a superheroine, Celeste. Following the 6-issue miniseries was the single-issue story Martial Law Takes Manhattan, where a former super soldier, now calling himself the Persecutor, which was an analog to Marvel's Punisher, claims insanity after he commits a heinous crime. So he's taken to a mental institution to have his mental state determined before trial. All of the patients in this mental hospital are analogs to Marvel characters, and it's easy to tell who they are inspired by. Martial Law travels to Manhattan to bring the Persecutor to justice, so he runs into the Marvel Universe heroes as he attempts to fulfill his duty. The next Martial Law story was The Hateful Dead, where he battles reanimated corpses of superheroes, who are brought back to life by toxic chemicals that soaked into the graves, transforming them into zombies, and Super Babylon is part 2 of this story. The next story was Pinhead vs. Martial Law, where he faces the popular horror character. Then there was Martial Law versus the Secret Tribunal, which are modeled after the Legion of Superheroes. He discovers an alien creature similar to the one in the Alien films has returned to Earth in the spaceship that Public Spirit traveled to deep space in. Martial Law also appeared in separate stories involving the Mask and Savage Dragon. In Martial Law Kingdom of the Blind, Martial Law battles a twisted version of Batman. There were also two novellas that were collected in the book Martial Law Origins, written by Martial Law co-creator Pat Mills, with illustrations drawn by the other co-creator of Martial Law, artist Kevin O'Neill. So if you enjoy dark, grim superhero stories or satire, I would recommend Martial Law. He does an excellent job in exploring the excesses that are possible in a world full of superheroes. Next is not so much a favorite comic book title, but a favorite comic book creator. Terry Moore is on my short list of comic book creators that I will buy anything that he does. He self-publishes through his company Abstract Studios and is most famously known for Strangers in Paradise, a 90-issue series that I was late to the party with, picking up with issue 74. It's about the long-term relationship between two women, Francine and Kachu, and their friend David Quinn. The series had a large supporting cast with lots of twists and turns in their relationships. After Strangers in Paradise, Terry Moore had a 30-issue series called Echo, which was a science fiction series where a photographer named Julie witnessed the explosion of an experimental battlesuit worn by test pilot Annie Trotter. Fragments of the suit rained down. Part of it fell on Julie and her truck. She discovered that the parts of the suit that had coalesced on her body imparted her with some unusual abilities, and she also discovered that Annie's personality was echoing in her mind. Julie is eventually on the run from the company that invented this unusual metal and suit, planning to use it to power a black hole device. Next, there was a 42-issue series called Rachel Rising, where Rachel woke up and dug herself out of the shallow grave where she was murdered. She still wore the scars of the rope that had been used to choke her, and she begins an investigation of her own murder. This is a horror-themed series introducing some unusual mystical women. Then Terry Moore did a 10-issue series titled Motor Girl about Sam, or full name Samantha, is an Iraqi war veteran still suffering from PTSD, working alone in a junkyard, living with her talking gorilla friend Mike, when some friendly aliens visit her. A mysterious company wants to buy the junkyard she lives on, and they won't take no for an answer. With Strangers in Paradise 25, a 10-issue miniseries, Kachu leaves Francine and their family to stop a former Parker girl, who were an all-female criminal organization, from revealing secrets from the old organization and exposing Kachu's involvement with the gang. It leads into a new 10-issue series titled 5 Years, where a paper written by Lilith has been leaked to the world's nations. It contains a formula for an ultimate weapon, and labs around the world attempt to perfect it. The women of the Terry Moore universe unite to prevent their success, which could possibly result in the end of the world. The series is going to end soon. I think the last issue was about to come out when the coronavirus stopped the comic book industry. I would recommend a Terry Moore title to anyone who is not a comic book reader because it explores different genres. He creates very character-driven stories full of strong female characters. He develops well-paced, well-plotted stories. And that is why I would recommend any Terry Moore comic book series to anyone who does not read comic books. The next comic book series I want to mention is The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, written by Alan Moore and drawn by Kevin O'Neill. It began in 1999, and the final miniseries was published in 2019. Moore and O'Neill took classic characters from literature that were in the public domain and brought them together. The main group was composed by Wilhelmina Murray, or Mina as she's called, from Dracula, written by Bram Stoker, Alan Quatermain from the novel King Solomon's Mines by H. Rider Haggard, Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, written by Jules Verne, Dr. Henry Jekyll and Edward Hyde from The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde by Robert Louis Stevenson, and Hawley Griffin from The Invisible Man by H.G. Wells. Later, they would be joined by the unusual immortal who goes by Orlando. In Volume 1, the group was brought together, led by the mysterious head of MI5, known only as M, to fight a threat to the British Empire. And part of the mystery was who exactly this M was. Volume 2 had them fight the Martian invasion from War of the Worlds, also originally written by H.G. Wells. Volume 3 was the Black Dossier, where in the 1950s, Mina and Alan, who now also looks very young, break into MI5 to steal their files and all records about the now-defunct League. Volume 4 was The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Century. It was published in three parts, which take place in 1910, 1969, and 2009. Mina, Alan, and Orlando travel to London to stop an occultic threat to Earth. Things don't go smoothly for the trio, to say the least. Next came the Nemo trilogy, involving the adventures of Nemo's daughter, Johnny, who picked up her father's mantle as captain of the Nautilus. In Nemo, Heart of Ice, Johnny follows her father's footsteps and leads a second Nemo expedition into the Antarctic to almost as disastrous results as his Antarctic adventure. In Nemo, The Roses of Berlin, Johnny and her husband, Broad Arrow Jack, travel to Berlin to rescue their daughter Hira and her husband Armand Robier, who were captured by the Nazis. And in Nemo, River of Ghosts, an elderly Johnny travels in an updated Nautilus to South America into the Amazon to settle old scores with Aisha, previously thought dead, who was once queen of the land where the immortal pool was, who seems to have joined forces with exiled Nazis, similar to the story The Boys of Brazil. The series concluded with The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, The Tempest. After the events of Century, Mina and Orlando take Emma Knight, the old head of MI5, to Aisha's Fountain of Youth, restoring her to her youthful beauty. All three are now fugitives, and a familiar character from Black Dossier has now become the new head of MI5 and began putting the pieces together about the truth of the old League. He travels to the same Fountain of Youth in pursuit of the three women. Meanwhile, a heroine from the future travels back in time to stop a catastrophe. The new head of MI5 attempts to destroy the Blazing World, and Mina, Orlando, and Emma, as well as Jack Nemo, discover that the Blazing World have their own plans for Earth, forcing this new League to travel on a new Nautilus very different from any previous version. This story wraps up the entire series in a very satisfying fashion. Also, Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill announced before Tempest was published that this was their final comic book story. Writer Jess Nevins wrote several books of annotations for The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Heroes and Monsters, the unofficial companion to The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, A Blazing World, the unofficial companion to the second League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and Impossible Territories, an unofficial companion to The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Black Dossier. He's also done annotations for the rest of the series through the first issue of The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen The Tempest at his website jessnevins.com/annotations, and that's spelled J-E-S-S-N-E-V-I-N-S. And he has also done annotations for Kingdom Come. These annotations really help develop your appreciation for the depth of storytelling in the entire League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. And it's a great introduction to some of the classic characters from literature. My favorite comic book series of all time was Planetary, which was a 27-issue series from 1999 to 2009, written by Warren Ellis, with art by John Cassaday, and colored by Laura Dupuy, who would later get married and become Laura Martin. Planetary is an organization that describes themselves as mystery archaeologists who uncover the secret history of the world to preserve. One of the main characters is Elijah Snow, an old man who wears a white suit, born in the first seconds of the 20th century, January 1st, 1900, along with various others who were born around the same time, who also had been born with various other extra normal and superhuman abilities. Snow was able to generate cold or extract heat. The other main characters are Jaquita Wagner, who is strong, fast, and almost invulnerable, and the drummer, a young man who is able to control any technical device or information, including broadcast signals. Another character who is part of the team is Ambrose Chase, who is able to create what can only be described as a selective physics distortion field, which can slow and almost temporarily stop time in a small area. Their major enemy is known only as the Four, who are obviously modeled after Marvel's Fantastic Four, who also want to uncover the secret history of the world, but for more nefarious motives. The Planetary organization explores the popular culture of the 20th century. The characters that they run across are analogs for pulp culture characters, including superheroes and other sources of popular culture. They also appeared in three stories involving other superhero universes, one involving the Wildstorm group of heroes known as the Authority. Bruce Wayne, Clark Kent, and Diana Prince run into an alternate version of Planetary in another story. And in a third, the Planetary organization winds up bumping into Batman from different dimensions. All three of these stories were published together in the volume titled Crossing Worlds. My first issue was number 19, the cover of which played an homage to the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, where Elijah Snow tries to strand one of the members of the Four on an unusual spaceship that's flying through our solar system, which bears a strange resemblance to, years later, would be the unusual bit of rock called Oumuamua, which was almost cigar-shaped, that passed through our solar system a few years ago. What I enjoyed about Planetary is that it stretches the possibility of comic book storytelling in a very sophisticated way. While not every plot thread in the series is wrapped up by the end, the final issue of the series does a satisfying job of wrapping up the story, and we learn what exactly Planetary wishes to do with the secret history they uncover. You can read the series either in four trade paperbacks or in a hardcover omnibus, so they are very easy to get. Hi, my name is Billy Hogan, host of the Superman Fan Podcast, and I go by Superman Fan on the forums. I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about the podcast and why I began doing it and what it's about. I've been doing the Superman Fan Podcast since 2008. The genesis of the podcast go back to the previous year when I discovered a comic book themed radio show called Fanboy Radio, which broadcast on KTCU, the Texas Christian University College radio station. The show was available online and on iTunes. Then I discovered that there was a Windows version of iTunes, which I downloaded. So I began searching for Superman podcasts, but sadly, I discovered that only the Superman homepage was doing a Superman-themed podcast unrelated to the TV show Smallville. In recent years, the Superman homepage has moved their podcasts. Instead of doing them on iTunes, they have a YouTube channel. But going back to 2007, needless to say, I was disappointed that there were not as that many Superman podcasts, so it led me to the decision to do one myself. So in January of 2008, I began a 30-minute podcast looking at various aspects of the publishing history involving the Man of Steel, as a way that I hoped of getting listeners interested in Superman. At the beginning, there was no chronological order. I would jump across eras and touch on any subject involving the Man of Steel that happened to catch my interest for that particular week. The Superman homepage has a calendar on their website, which includes birthdays of various actors or directors involved with Superman shows or movies, comic book creators, or even Superman characters. So when appropriate, I would do an episode on a particular birthday. Also, eventually, I would feature issues of Action Comics or Superman. Every 25 issues, like Superman 100, Action 100, etc. Then, during the summers, I would concentrate on some of the imaginary stories in Superman history. And for those who aren't familiar with Silver Age comic books, DC would sometimes do imaginary stories involving various characters of the Superman family that they would never do in regular continuity, like have Superman get married to Lois, Lana, or even Lori Lamaris, the Mermaid, or they might even kill off Superman. Then, in 2010, more Superman podcasts began to appear. There were two involving the Golden Age Superman stories, one concentrating on the Bronze Age from the 70s to the mid-80s, another concentrated on the 1980s reboot up through Final Crisis, and another on the then-current Superman issues. I noticed there was one gap in all of these Superman podcasts, and that involved the Silver Age from the mid-1950s on up to 1970. And since that was the era when I began to learn to read in the mid-1960s, I thought, why not? In 2011, I began indexing the Silver Age Adventures of Superman. As I prepared to begin covering the Silver Age Adventures of Superman, I found that determining when the Silver Age began for the Man of Steel was not that easy to determine. Jimmy Olsen got his own series beginning in 1954, and that's also the year when Superman and Batman appeared in the same story in World's Finest Comics. Before that, they would appear together on the cover, but Superman would have his own story in World's Finest, and Batman would appear in his own story, but they would never have an adventure together until in the mid-50s, and they had to cut the number of pages in comic books to keep the titles at a 10-cent cover price, and so they decided that they had no choice but to put Superman and Batman in the same story together. But in regards to the main titles involving the Man of Steel, Action Comics, and Superman, determining when the Silver Age began with those titles, there was no clear demarcation as to where the Golden Age of Superman ended and the Silver Age began. But I did get some help from Showcase Presents Superman Volume 1. For those of you who may not be familiar with Showcase Presents, they were thick books that used newsprint to print the black and white adventures of various Silver Age DC characters, and the first volume began with Action Comics number 241, published in 1958, and it began with the Super Key to Fort Superman, which was the first story involving the Man of Steel's Arctic Fortress of Solitude, which became a staple of the Silver Age. And so I thought I would begin covering Superman's adventures in Superman and Action Comics with that issue. The biggest puzzle I could never solve was where the Silver Age began for Superboy, because his first appearance was in More Fun Comics number 101, published in 1945, and the first issue of Superboy was published in 1949. So I decided to skip Superboy's stories for the time being, along with the Justice League of America, mainly because I wanted to concentrate on the titles that I read when I was a kid and just concentrate on the main titles involving the Man of Steel, except for World's Finest Comics, which was another title I read fondly as a kid. So on the Superman Fan Podcast, I cover the Silver Age stories in chronological order, involving the titles Action Comics, Superman, Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, Superman's Girlfriend Lois Lane, and World's Finest Comics. And I also include Supergirl's Adventures, which right now in the mid-1960s where I'm at, she appears in the back of Action Comics. When I reach what is considered the end of the Silver Age of Superman with Mort Weisinger's retirement in 1970, I don't plan to stop. I do plan to continue covering the Bronze Age because I enjoyed reading those titles as well. And I don't plan on stopping as long as I can keep doing the podcast. When I do begin covering the Bronze Age, I think I'm going to alternate and start covering Superboy's adventures, beginning with his first appearance in More Fun Comics number 101, and alternate between covering the Bronze Age and covering Superboy's adventures from the beginning. But I've got a few years left before I reach that point, and I haven't quite calculated when that will be. The website for the podcast is thesupermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com, and you can send email to supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com. The podcast has a Facebook group and page, and is on Twitter at Superman Podcast. It's also on Tumblr, Medium, Flipboard, TuneIn, Stitcher, Instagram, Google Podcasts, and the Internet Archive. As we all wait for comic books to begin distribution again as we recover during this coronavirus epidemic, I would like to hear about other comic book podcasters and what their podcast is all about. I'm always looking for another good comic book podcast. I look forward to hearing your recommendations, and thanks again, John, for allowing us to share our interest in the comic book medium during these trying times.
Remember, the clips in these episodes of the Recommendation Roundtable are picked by listeners like you. The way these episodes work is you send in clips recommending various forms of entertainment that you think other listeners might find interesting. Whenever I get enough clips to fill an episode, I'll put one together and kick it out. There are no deadlines on these. Just send in clips if, hey, this is a fun way to spend your time, be it a video game, a book, a movie, a television show, a board game, whatever. We're all geeks. We all like similar things. Let's help each other find various forms of entertainment we find interesting. The guidelines for these episodes are simple. One pick per clip. Now that pick could be a particular movie, it could be a string of movies, it could be a particular novel, a string of novels, it could be whatever, just a conceptual thing. And I'm not going to get too wrapped around the axle on this, it's just, don't be recommending two things in the same clip, that way I've got the option of inserting something in between from somebody else, just to give the episodes a little variety and such. Now, if the two things are related, then yeah, do them as a bundle if you want to, that's fine too. Again, nothing too crazy. The only real rule is no profanity. This is a all-ages podcast. So with that in mind, if you've got something that you think is great for younger listeners, recommend that and say, hey, if you've got kids or whatever, or if you're a younger listener, you might find this, or if it's all ages, just tell us who your pick is targeted to and why they might enjoy this form of entertainment. And that's really all there is to it. So once again, there are no deadlines. It's an open invitation and open submission all the time. Whenever I get enough clips, I'll do another one of these episodes. So the future of the Recommendation Roundtable is in your hands.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.